and in one book, and he would get another on that subject. He branched out erratically in all directions. He read volumes of specialized erudition first, and high school primers afterward. There was no order in his reading, but there was order in what remained of it in his mind. He discovered the reading room of the public library, and he went there for a while, to study the layout. Then one day, at various times, a succession of young boys, painfully combed and unconvincingly washed, came to visit the reading room. They were thin when they came, but not when they left. That evening, Gale Winand had a small library of his own in the corner of his basement. His gang had executed his orders without protest. It was a scandalous assignment. No self-respecting gang had ever looted anything as pointless as books. But Stretch Winand had given the orders, and one did not argue with Stretch Winand. He was 15 when he was found one morning in the gutter, a mass of bleeding pulp, both legs broken, beaten by some drunken longshoreman. He was unconscious when found. But he had been conscious that night after the beating. He had been left alone in a dark alley. He had seen a light around the corner. Nobody knew how he could have managed to drag himself around that corner, but he had. They saw the long smear of blood on the pavement afterward. He had crawled, able to move nothing but his arms. He had knocked against the bottom of a door. It was a saloon, still open. The saloon keeper came out. It was the only time in his life that Gale Winand asked for help. The saloon keeper looked at him with a flat, heavy glance, a glance that showed full consciousness of agony, of injustice, and a stolid, bovine indifference. The saloon keeper went inside and slammed the door. He had no desire to get mixed up with gang fights. Years later, Gale Winand, publisher of the New York Banner, still knew the names of the longshoreman and the saloon keeper and where to find them. He never did anything to the longshoreman, but he caused the saloon keeper's business to be ruined, his home and savings to be lost, and drove the man to suicide. Gale Winand was 16 when his father died. He was alone, jobless at the moment, with 65 cents in his pocket, an unpaid rent bill, and a chaotic erudition. He decided that the time had come to decide what he would make of his life. He went that night to the roof of his tenement and looked at the lights of the city, a city where he did not run things. He let his eyes move slowly from the windows of the sagging hovels around him to the windows of the mansions in the distance. There were only lighted squares hanging in space, but he could tell from them the quality of the structures to which they belonged. The lights around him looked muddy, discouraged. Those in the distance were clean and tight. He asked himself a single question. What was there that entered all those houses, the dim and the brilliant alike? What reached into every room, into every person? They all had bread. Could one rule men through the bread they bought? They had shoes. They had coffee. They had... The course of his life was set. Next morning he walked into the office of the editor of the Gazette, a fourth-rate newspaper in a run-down building, and asked for a job in the city room. The editor looked at his clothes and inquired, "Can you spell cat?" "Can you spell anthropomorphology?" asked Winand. "We have no jobs here," said the editor. "I'll hang around," said Winand. "Use me when you want to. You don't have to pay me. You'll put me on salary when you'll feel you'd better." He remained in the building, sitting on the stairs outside the city room. He sat there every day for a week. No one paid any attention to him. At night he slept in doorways. When most of his money was gone, he stole food from counters or from garbage pails before returning to his post on the stairs. One day a reporter felt sorry for him, and walking down the stairs threw a nickel into Winand's lap, saying, "Go buy yourself a bowl of stew, kid." Winand had a dime left in his pocket. He took the dime and threw it at the reporter, saying, "Go buy yourself a screw." The man swore and went on down. The nickel and the dime remained lying on the steps. Winand would not touch them. The story was repeated in the city room. A pimply-faced clerk shrugged and took the 2 coins. At the end of the week, in a rush hour, a man from the city room called Winand to run an errand. Other small chores followed. He obeyed with military precision. In 10 days, he was on salary. In 6 months, he was a reporter. In 2 years, he was an associate editor. Gail Winant was 20 when he fell in love. He had known everything there was to know about sex since the age of 13. He had had many girls. He never spoke of love, created no romantic illusion, and treated the whole matter as a simple animal transaction. But at this he was an expert, and women could tell it just by looking at him. The girl with whom he fell in love had an exquisite beauty, a beauty to be worshipped, not desired. She was fragile and silent. Her face told of the lovely mysteries within her, left unexpressed. She became Gail Winan's mistress. He allowed himself the weakness of being happy. He would have married her at once, had she mentioned it. But they said little to each other. He felt that everything was understood between them. One evening he spoke. Sitting at her feet, his face raised to her, he allowed his soul to be heard. "My darling, anything you wish, anything I am, anything I can ever be, that's what I want to offer you. Not the things I'll get for you, but the thing in me that will make me able to get them. That thing, a man can't renounce it, but I want to renounce it, so that it will be yours, so that it will be in your service. Only for you." The girl smiled and asked, "Do you think I'm prettier than Maggie Kelly?" He got up. He said nothing and walked out of the house. He never saw that girl again. Gail Winant, who prided himself on never needing a lesson twice, did not fall in love again in the years that followed. He was 21 when his career on the Gazette was threatened. For the first and only time. Politics and corruption had never disturbed him. He knew all about it. His gang had been paid to help stage beatings at the polls on election days. But when Pat Mulligan, police captain of his precinct, was framed, Winant could not take it, because Pat Mulligan was the only honest man he had ever met in his life. The Gazette was controlled by the powers that had framed Mulligan. Winant said nothing. He merely put in order in his mind such items of information he possessed as would blow the Gazette into hell. His job would be blown with it, but that did not matter. His decision contradicted every rule he had laid down for his career, but he did not think. It was one of the rare explosions that hit him at times, throwing him beyond caution, making of him a creature possessed by the single impulse to have his way, because the rightness of his way was so blindingly total. But he knew that the destruction of the Gazette would be only a first step. It was not enough to save Mulligan. For 3 years, Winant had kept one small clipping, an editorial on corruption by the famous editor of a great newspaper. He had kept it because it was the most beautiful tribute to integrity he had ever read. He took the clipping and went to see the great editor. He would tell him about Mulligan, and together they would beat the machine. He walked far across town to the building of the famous paper. He had to walk. It helped to control the fury within him. He was admitted into the office of the editor. He had a way of getting admitted into places against all rules. He saw a fat man at a desk, with thin slits of eyes, set close together. He did not introduce himself, but laid the clipping down on the desk and asked, "Do you remember this?" The editor glanced at the clipping, then at Winant. It was a glance Winant had seen before, in the eyes of the saloon keeper who had slammed the door.
"How do you expect me to remember every piece of swill I write?" asked the editor.
After a moment, Winant said, "Thanks." It was the only time in his life that he felt gratitude to anyone. The gratitude was genuine, a payment for a lesson he would never need again. But even the editor knew there was something very wrong in that short thanks, and very frightening. He did not know that it had been an obituary on Gail Winant. Winant walked back to the Gazette, feeling no anger toward the editor or the political machine. He felt only a furious contempt for himself, for Pat Mulligan, for all integrity. He felt shame when he thought of those whose victims he and Mulligan had been willing to become. He did not think victims, he thought suckers. He got back to the office and wrote a brilliant editorial blasting Captain Mulligan.
"Why, I thought you kind of felt sorry for the poor bastard," said his editor, pleased.
"I don't feel sorry for anyone," said Winant.
Grocers and deckhands had not appreciated Gail Winant. Politicians did. In his years on the paper, he had learned how to get along with people. His face had assumed the expression it was to wear for the rest of his life. Not quite a smile, but a motionless look of irony directed at the whole world. People could presume that his mockery was intended for the particular things they wished to mock. Besides, it was pleasant to deal with a man untroubled by passion or sanctity. He was 23 when a rival political gang, intent on winning a municipal election and needing a newspaper to plug a certain issue, bought the Gazette. They bought it in the name of Gale Winand, who was to serve as a respectable front for the machine. Gale Winand became editor-in-chief. He plugged the issue. He won the election for his bosses. 2 years later, he smashed the gang, sent its leaders to the penitentiary, and remained a sole owner of the Gazette. His first act was to tear down the sign over the door of the building and to throw out the paper's old masthead. The Gazette became the New York Banner. His friends objected. "Publishers don't change the name of a paper," they told him. "This one does," he said. The first campaign of the Banner was an appeal for money for a charitable cause. Displayed side by side with an equal amount of space, the Banner ran two stories. One about a struggling young scientist, starving in a garret, working on a great invention. The other about a chambermaid, the sweetheart of an executed murderer, awaiting the birth of her illegitimate child. One story was illustrated with scientific diagrams, the other with the picture of a loose-mouthed girl wearing a tragic expression and disarranged clothes. The Banner asked its readers to help both these unfortunates. It received $9.45 for the young scientist. It received $1,077 for the unwed mother. Gale Winand called a meeting of his staff. He put down on the table the paper carrying both stories and the money collected for both funds. "Is there anyone here who doesn't understand?" he asked. No one answered. He said, "Now you all know the kind of paper the Banner is to be." The publishers of his time took pride in stamping their individual personalities upon their newspapers. Gale Winand delivered his paper, body and soul, to the mob. The Banner assumed the appearance of a circus poster in body, of a circus performance in soul. It accepted the same goal, to stun, to amuse, and to collect admission. It bore the imprint not of one, but of a million men. "Men differ in their virtues, if any," said Gale Winand, explaining his policy, "but they are alike in their vices." He added, looking straight into the questioner's eyes, "I am serving that which exists on this earth in greatest quantity. I am representing the majority. Surely an act of virtue." The public asked for crime, scandal, and sentiment. Gale Winand provided it. He gave people what they wanted, plus a justification for indulging the tastes of which they had been ashamed. The Banner presented murder, arson, rape, corruption, with an appropriate moral against each. There were three columns of details to one stick of moral. "If you make people perform a noble duty, it bores them," said Winand. "If you make them indulge themselves, it shames them. But combine the two, and you've got them." He ran stories about fallen girls, society divorces, foundling asylums, red-light districts, charity hospitals. "Sex first," said Winand. "Tears second. Make them itch and make them cry, and you've got them." The Banner led great, brave crusades on issues that had no opposition. It exposed politicians, one step ahead of the grand jury. It attacked monopolies in the name of the downtrodden. It mocked the rich and the successful in the manner of those who could never be either. It overstressed the glamour of society and presented society news with a subtle sneer. This gave the man on the street two satisfactions, that of entering illustrious drawing rooms and that of not wiping his feet on the threshold. The Banner was permitted to strain truth, taste, and credibility, but not its readers' brain power. Its enormous headlines, glaring pictures, and oversimplified text hit the senses and entered men's consciousness without any necessity for an intermediary process of reason, like food shot through the rectum, requiring no digestion. "News," Gale Winand told his staff, "is that which will create the greatest excitement among the greatest number. The thing that will knock them silly. The sillier the better, provided there's enough of them." One day he brought into the office a man he had picked off the street. It was an ordinary man, neither well-dressed nor shabby, neither tall nor short, neither dark nor quite blonde. He had the kind of face one could not remember even while looking at it. He was frightening by being so totally undifferentiated. He lacked even the positive distinction of a half-wit. Wynand took him through the building, introduced him to every member of the staff, and let him go. Then Wynand called his staff together and told them, "When in doubt about your work, remember that man's face. You're writing for him." "But Mr. Wynand," said a young editor, "one can't remember his face."
"That's the point," said Wynand.
When the name of Gail Wynand became a threat in the publishing world, a group of newspaper owners took him aside at a city charity affair which all had to attend, and reproached him for what they called his debasement of the public taste. "It is not my function," said Wynand, "to help people preserve a self-respect they haven't got. You give them what they profess to like in public, I give them what they really like. Honesty is the best policy, gentlemen, though not quite in the sense you were taught to believe." It was impossible for Wynand not to do a job well. Whatever his aim, his means were superlative. All the drive, the force, the will, barred from the pages of his paper, went into its making. An exceptional talent was burned prodigally to achieve perfection in the unexceptional. A new religious faith could have been founded on the energy of spirit which he spent upon collecting lurid stories and smearing them across sheets of paper. The Banner was always first with the news. When an earthquake occurred in South America and no communications came from the stricken area, Wynand chartered a liner, sent a crew down to the scene, and had extras on the streets of New York days ahead of his competitors. Extras with drawings that represented flames, chasms, and crushed bodies. When an SOS was received from a ship sinking in a storm off the Atlantic coast, Wynand himself sped to the scene with his crew ahead of the Coast Guard. Wynand directed the rescue and brought back an exclusive story with photographs of himself climbing a ladder over raging waves, a baby in his arms. When a Canadian village was cut off from the world by an avalanche, it was the Banner that sent a balloon to drop food and Bibles to the inhabitants. When a coal mining community was paralyzed by a strike, the Banner opened soup kitchens and printed tragic stories on the perils confronting the miners' pretty daughters under the pressure of poverty. When a kitten got trapped on the top of a pole, it was rescued by a Banner photographer. "When there's no news, make it," was Wynand's order. A lunatic escaped from a state institution for the insane. After days of terror for miles around, terror fed by the Banner's dire predictions and its indignation at the inefficiency of the local police, he was captured by a reporter of the Banner. The lunatic recovered miraculously 2 weeks after his capture, was released, and sold to the Banner an exposé of the ill-treatment he had suffered at the institution. It led to sweeping reforms. Afterward, some people said that the lunatic had worked on the Banner before his commitment. It could never be proved. A fire broke out in a sweatshop employing 30 young girls. Two of them perished in the disaster. Mary Watson, one of the survivors, gave the Banner an exclusive story about the exploitation they had suffered. It led to a crusade against sweatshops, headed by the best woman of the city. The origin of the fire was never discovered. It was whispered that Mary Watson had once been Evelyn Drake, who wrote for the Banner. It could not be proved. In the first years of the Banner's existence, Gail Wynand spent more nights on his office couch than in his bedroom. The effort he demanded of his employees was hard to perform. The effort of himself was hard to believe. He drove them like an army. He drove himself like a slave. He paid them well. He got nothing but his rent and meals. He lived in a furnished room at the time when his best reporters lived in suites at expensive hotels. He spent money faster than it came in, and he spent it all on the Banner. The paper was like a luxurious mistress whose every need was satisfied without inquiry about the price. The Banner was first to get the newest typographical equipment. The Banner was last to get the best newspapermen, last because it kept them. Wynand raided his competitors' city rooms. Nobody could meet the salaries he offered. His procedure evolved into a simple formula. When a newspaper man received an invitation to call on Wynand, he took it as an insult to his journalistic integrity, but he came to the appointment. He came, prepared to deliver a set of offensive conditions on which he would accept the job, if at all. Wynand began the interview by stating the salary he would pay. Then he added, "You might wish, of course, to discuss other conditions." And seeing the swallowing movement in the man's throat, concluded, "No, fine. Report to me on Monday." When Wynand opened his second paper, in Philadelphia, The local publishers met him like European chieftains united against the invasion of Attila. The war that followed was as savage. Wynand laughed over it. No one could teach him anything about hiring thugs to hijack a paper's delivery wagons and beat up news vendors. Two of his competitors perished in the battle. The Wynand Philadelphia Star survived. The rest was swift and simple, like an epidemic. By the time he reached the age of 35, there were Wynand papers in all the key cities of the United States. By the time he was 40, there were Wynand magazines, Wynand newsreels, and most of the Wynand Enterprises, Inc. A great many activities, not publicized, helped to build his fortune. He had forgotten nothing of his childhood. He remembered the things he had thought, standing as a bootblack at the rail of a ferry boat, the chances offered by a growing city. He bought real estate, where no one expected it to become valuable. He built, against all advice, and he ran hundreds into thousands. He bought his way into a great many enterprises of all kinds. Sometimes they crashed, ruining everybody concerned, save Gale Wynand. He staged a crusade against a shady streetcar monopoly and caused it to lose its franchise. The franchise was granted to a shadier group, controlled by Gale Wynand. He exposed a vicious attempt to corner the beef market in the Middle West and left the field clear for another gang, operating under his orders. He was helped by a great many people who discovered that young Wynand was a bright fellow, worth using. He exhibited a charming complacence about being used. In each case, the people found that they had been used instead, like the men who bought the Gazette for Gale Wynand. Sometimes he lost money on his investments, coldly and with full intention. Through a series of untraceable steps, he ruined many powerful men. The president of a bank, the head of an insurance company, the owner of a steamship line, and others. No one could discover his motives. The men were not his competitors, and he gained nothing from their destruction. "Whatever that bastard Wynand is after," people said, "it's not after money." Those who denounced him too persistently were run out of their professions, some in a few weeks, others many years later. There were occasions when he let insults pass unnoticed. There were occasions when he broke a man for an innocuous remark. One could never tell what he would avenge and what he would forgive. One day he noticed the brilliant work of a young reporter on another paper and sent for him. The boy came, but the salary Wynand mentioned had no effect on him. "I can't work for you, Mr. Wynand," he said with desperate earnestness, "because you have no ideals." Wynand's thin lip smiled. "You can't escape human depravity, kid," he said gently. "The boss you work for may have ideals, but he has to beg money and take orders from many contemptible people. I have no ideals, but I don't beg. Take your choice. There's no other." The boy went back to his paper. A year later he came to Wynand and asked if his offer were still open. Wynand said that it was. The boy had remained on the banner ever since. He was the only one on the staff who loved Gale Wynand. Alva Skerritt, sole survivor of the original Gazette, had risen with Wynand. But one could not say that he loved Wynand. He merely clung to his boss with the automatic devotion of a rug under Wynand's feet. Alva Skerritt had never hated anything, and so was incapable of love. He was shrewd, competent, and unscrupulous, in the innocent manner of one unable to grasp the conception of a scruple. He believed everything he wrote, and everything written in the banner. He could hold a belief for all of 2 weeks. He was invaluable to Wynand, as a barometer of public reaction. No one could say whether Gale Wynand had a private life. His hours away from the office had assumed the style of the banner's front page, but a style raised to a grand plane, as if he were still playing circus, only to a gallery of kings. He bought out the entire house for a grand opera performance, and sat alone in the empty auditorium with his current mistress. He discovered a beautiful play by an unknown playwright and paid him a huge sum to have the play performed once and never again. Wynand was the sole spectator at the single performance. The script was burned next morning. When a distinguished society woman asked him to contribute to a worthy charity cause, Wynand handed her a signed blank check and laughed, confessing that the amount she dared to fill in was less than he would have given otherwise. He bought some kind of Balkan throne for a penniless pretender whom he met in a speakeasy, and never bothered to see afterward. He often referred to my valet, my chauffeur, and my king. At night, dressed in a shabby suit bought for $9, Wynand would often ride the subways and wander through the dives of slum districts, listening to his public. Once, in a basement beer joint, he heard a truck driver denouncing Gail Wynand as the worst exponent of capitalistic evils, in a language of colorful accuracy. Wynand agreed with him, and helped him out with a few expressions of his own from his Hell's Kitchen vocabulary. Then Wynand picked up a copy of the banner left by someone on a table, tore his own photograph from page 3, clipped it to a $100 bill, handed it to the truck driver, and walked out before anyone could utter a word. The succession of his mistresses was so rapid that it ceased to be gossip. It was said that he never enjoyed a woman unless he had bought her, and that she had to be the kind who could not be bought. He kept the details of his life secret by making it glaringly public as a whole. He had delivered himself to the crowd. He was anyone's property, like a monument in a park, like a bus stop sign, like the pages of the banner. His photographs appeared in his papers more often than pictures of movie stars. He had been photographed in all kinds of clothes, on every imaginable occasion. He had never been photographed naked, but his readers felt as if he had. He derived no pleasure from personal publicity. It was merely a matter of policy, to which he submitted. Every corner of his penthouse had been reproduced in his papers and magazines. "Every bastard in the country knows the inside of my icebox and bathtub," he said. One phase of his life, however, was little known and never mentioned. The top floor of the building under his penthouse was his private art gallery. It was locked. He had never admitted anyone except the caretaker. A few people knew about it. Once a French ambassador asked him for permission to visit it. Wynand refused. Occasionally, not often, he would descend to his gallery and remain there for hours. The things he collected were chosen by standards of his own. He had famous masterpieces. He had canvases by unknown artists. He rejected the works of immortal names for which he did not care. The estimates set by collectors and the matter of great signatures were of no concern to him. The art dealers whom he patronized reported that his judgment was that of a master. One night his valet saw Wynand returning from the art gallery below and was shocked by the expression of his face. It was a look of suffering, yet the face seemed 10 years younger. "Are you ill, sir?" he asked. Wynand looked at him indifferently and said, "Go to bed." "We could make a swell spread for the Sunday Scandal sheet out of your art gallery," said Alva Skerritt wistfully.
"No," said Wynand.
"But why, Gail?" "Look, Alva, every man on earth has a soul of his own that nobody can stare at. Even the convicts in a penitentiary and the freaks in a sideshow, everybody but me. My soul is spread in your Sunday Scandal sheet, in 3-color process. So I must have a substitute, even if it's only a locked room and a few objects not to be pawed."
It was a long process, and there had been premonitory signs, but Skerritt did not notice a certain new trait in Gail Wynand's character until Wynand was 45. Then it became apparent to many. Wynand lost interest in breaking industrialists and financiers. He found a new kind of victim. People could not tell whether it was a sport, a mania, or a systematic pursuit. They thought it was horrible because it seemed so vicious and pointless. It began with the case of Dwight Carson. Dwight Carson was a talented young writer who had achieved the spotless reputation of a man passionately devoted to his convictions. He upheld the cause of the individual against the masses. He wrote for magazines of great prestige and small circulation, which were no threat to Wynand. Wynand bought Dwight Carson. He forced Carson to write a column on the Banner, dedicated to preaching the superiority of the masses over the man of genius. It was a bad column, dull and unconvincing. It made many people angry. It was a waste of space and of a big salary. Wynand insisted on continuing it. Even Alva Skerritt was shocked by Carson's apostasy.
"Anybody else, Gail," he said. "But honest, I didn't expect it of Carson."
Wynand laughed. He laughed too long, as if he could not stop it. His laughter had an edge of hysteria. Skerritt frowned. He did not like the sight of Wynand being unable to control an emotion. It contradicted everything he knew of Wynand. It gave Skerrett a funny feeling of apprehension, like the sight of a tiny crack in a solid wall. The crack could not possibly endanger the wall, except that it had no business being there. A few months later, Wynand bought a young writer from a radical magazine, a man known for his honesty, and put him to work on a series of articles glorifying exceptional men and damning the masses. That, too, made a great many of his readers angry. He continued it. He seemed not to care any longer about the delicate signs of effect on circulation. He hired a sensitive poet to cover baseball games. He hired an art expert to handle financial news. He got a socialist to defend factory owners and a conservative to champion labor. He forced an atheist to write on the glories of religion. He made a disciplined scientist proclaim the superiority of mystical intuition over the scientific method. He gave a great symphony conductor a munificent yearly income, for no work at all, on the sole condition that he never conduct an orchestra again. Some of these men had refused at first, but they surrendered when they found themselves on the edge of bankruptcy through a series of untraceable circumstances within a few years. Some of the men were famous, others obscure. Wynand showed no interest in the previous standing of his prey. He showed no interest in men of glittering success who had commercialized their careers and held no particular beliefs of any kind. His victims had a single attribute in common: their immaculate integrity. Once they were broken, Wynand continued to pay them scrupulously, but he felt no further concern for them and no desire to see them again. Dwight Carson became a dipsomaniac. Two men became drug addicts. One committed suicide. This last was too much for Skerrett. "Isn't it going too far, Gale?" he asked. "That was practically murder." "Not at all," said Wynand. "I was merely an outside circumstance. The cause was in him. If lightning strikes a rotten tree and it collapses, it's not the fault of the lightning."
"But what do you call a healthy tree?"
"They don't exist, Alva," said Wynand cheerfully.
"They don't exist."
Alva Skerrett never asked Wynand for an explanation of this new pursuit. By some dim instinct, Skerrett guessed a little of the reason behind it. Skerrett shrugged and laughed, telling people that it was nothing to worry about. It was just a safety valve. Only two men understood Gale Wynand. Alva Skerrett, partially. Ellsworth Toohey, completely. Ellsworth Toohey, who wished above all to avoid a quarrel with Wynand at that time, could not refrain from a feeling of resentment because Wynand had not chosen him as a victim. He almost wished Wynand would try to corrupt him, no matter what the consequences. But Wynand seldom noticed his existence. Wynand had never been afraid of death. Through the years, the thought of suicide had occurred to him, not as an intention, but as one of the many possibilities among the chances of life. He examined it indifferently, with polite curiosity, as he examined any possibility, and then forgot it. He had known moments of blank exhaustion when his will deserted him. He had always cured himself by a few hours in his art gallery. Thus he reached the age of 51, and a day when nothing of consequence happened to him. Yet the evening found him without desire to make a step farther. Gale Wynand sat on the edge of the bed, slumped forward, his elbows on his knees, the gun on the palm of his hand. "Yes," he told himself. "There's an answer there somewhere. But I don't want to know it. I don't want to know it." And because he felt a pang of dread at the root of this desire not to examine his life further, he knew that he would not die tonight. As long as he still feared something, he had a foothold on living, even if it meant only moving forward to an unknown disaster. The thought of death gave him nothing. The thought of living gave him a slender alms, the hint of fear. He moved his hand, weighing the gun. He smiled, a faint smile of derision. "No," he thought, "that's not for you, not yet. You still have the sense of not wanting to die senselessly. You were stopped by that. Even that is a remnant of something." He tossed the gun aside on the bed, knowing that the moment was past and the thing was of no danger to him any longer. He got up. He felt no elation. He felt tired. But he was back in his normal course. There were no problems, except to finish this day quickly and go to sleep. He went down to his study to get a drink. When he switched on the light in the study, he saw Tui's present. It was a huge vertical crate standing by his desk. He had seen it earlier in the evening. He had thought, what the hell, and forgotten all about it. He poured himself a drink and stood sipping it slowly. The crate was too large to escape his field of vision, and as he drank, he tried to guess what it could possibly contain. It was too tall and slender for a piece of furniture. He could not imagine what material property Tui could wish to send him. He had expected something less tangible, a small envelope containing a hint at some sort of blackmail. So many people had tried to blackmail him, so unsuccessfully. He did think Tui would have more sense than that. By the time he finished his drink, he had found no plausible explanation for the crate. It annoyed him, like a stubborn crossword puzzle. He had a kit of tools somewhere in a drawer of his desk. He found it, and broke the crate open. It was Stephen Mallory's statue of Dominique Francon. Gail Winant walked to his desk and put down the pliers he held, as if they were of fragile crystal. Then he turned and looked at the statue again. He stood looking at it for an hour. Then he went to the telephone and dialed Tui's number.
"Hello,"
said Tui's voice, its hoarse impatience confessing that he had been awakened out of sound sleep. "All right, come over," said Winant, and hung up. Tui arrived half an hour later. It was his first visit to Winant's home. Winant himself answered the doorbell, still dressed in his pajamas. He said nothing and walked into the study, Tui following. The naked marble body, its head thrown back in exultation, made the room look like a place that did not exist any longer, like the Stoddard Temple. Winan's eyes rested on Tui expectantly, a heavy glance of suppressed anger.
"You want, of course, to know the name of the model?" Tui asked, with just a hint of triumph in his voice.
"Hell no," said Winant. "I want to know the name of the sculptor."
He wondered why Tui did not like the question. There was something more than disappointment in Tui's face.
"The sculptor?" said Tui. "Wait, let me see. I think I know it. It's Stephen, or Stanley something or other. Honestly, I don't remember."
"If you knew enough to buy this, you knew enough to ask the name and never forget it."
"I'll look it up, Mr. Winant."
"Where did you get this?"
"In some art shop, you know, one of those places on Second Avenue."
"How did it get there?"
"I don't know, I didn't ask. I bought it because I knew the model."
"You're lying about that. If that were all you saw in it, you wouldn't have taken the chance you took. You know that I've never let anyone see my gallery. Did you think I'd allow you the presumption of contributing to it? Nobody has ever dared offer me a gift of that kind. You wouldn't have risked it, unless you were sure, terribly sure of how great a work of art this is. Sure that I'd have to accept it. That you'd beat me. And you have."
"I'm glad to hear it, Mr. Winant."
"If you wish to enjoy that, I'll tell you also that I hate seeing this come from you. I hate your having been able to appreciate it. It doesn't fit you. Though I was obviously wrong about you. You're a greater art expert than I thought you were."
"Such as it is, I'll have to accept this as a compliment and thank you, Mr. Winant."
"Now what was it you wanted? You intended me to understand that you won't let me have this unless I grant an interview to Mrs. Peter Keating."
"Why, no, Mr. Winant. I've made you a present of it. I intended you only to understand that this is Mrs. Peter Keating."
Winant looked at the statue, then back at Tui.
"Oh, you damn fool," said Winant softly.
Tui stared at him, bewildered.
"So you really did use this as a red lamp in a window?"
Winant seemed relieved. He did not find it necessary to hold Tui's glance now.
"That's better, Tui. You're not as smart as I thought for a moment."
"But, Mr. Winant, what—"
"Didn't you realize that this statue would be the surest way to kill any possible appetite I have for your Mrs. Keating?"
"You haven't seen her, Mr. Winant."
"Oh, she's probably beautiful. She might be more beautiful than this, but she can't have what that sculptor has given her. And to see that same face, but without any meaning, like a dead caricature? Don't you think one would hate the woman for that?"
"You haven't seen her."
Oh, all right, I'll see you. I told you you should be allowed to get away with your stunt completely or not at all. I didn't promise you to lay her, did I? Only to see her.
That is all I wanted, Mr. Wynand.
Have her telephone my office and make an appointment.
Thank you, Mr. Wynand.
Besides, you're lying about not knowing the name of that sculptor, but it's too much bother to make you tell me. She'll tell me.
I'm sure she'll tell you. Though why should I lie?
God knows. By the way, if it had been a lesser sculptor, you'd have lost your job over this.
But after all, Mr. Wynand, I have a contract.
Oh, save that for your labor unions, Elsie. And now I think you should wish me a good night and get out of here.
Yes, Mr. Wynand, I wish you a good night.
Wynand accompanied him to the hall. At the door, Wynand said,
You're a poor businessman, Tui. I don't know why you're so anxious to have me meet Mrs. Keating. I don't know what your racket is in trying to get a commission for that Keating of yours. But whatever it is, it can't be so valuable that you should have been willing to part with a thing like this in exchange.
Chapter 2 Why didn't you wear your emerald bracelet? Asked Peter Keating. Gordon Prescott's so-called fiancé had everybody gaping at her star sapphire.
I'm sorry, Peter. I shall wear it next time, said Dominique.
It was a nice party. Did you have a good time?
I always have a good time.
So did I. Only... Oh, God. Do you want to know the truth?
No.
Dominique, I was bored to death. Vincent Knowlton is a pain in the neck. He's such a damn snob, I can't stand him. He added cautiously. I didn't show it, did I?
No, you behaved very well. You laughed at all his jokes, even when no one else did.
Oh, you noticed that? It always works.
Yes, I noticed that.
You think I shouldn't, don't you?
I haven't said that.
You think it's... low, don't you?
I don't think anything is low.
He slumped farther in his armchair. It made his chin press uncomfortably against his chest, but he did not care to move again. A fire crackled in the fireplace of his living room. He had turned out all the lights, save one lamp with a yellow silk shade. But it created no air of intimate relaxation. It only made the place look deserted, like a vacant apartment with the utilities shut off. Dominique sat at the other end of the room, her thin body fitted obediently to the contours of a straight-backed chair. She did not look stiff, only too poised for comfort. They were alone, but she sat like a lady at a public function, like a lovely dress dummy in a public show window, a window facing a busy intersection. They had come home from a tea party at the house of Vincent Knowlton, a prominent young society man, Keating's new friend. They had had a quiet dinner together, and now their evening was free. There were no other social engagements till tomorrow.
"You shouldn't have laughed at theosophy when you spoke to Mrs. Marsh," he said. "She believes in it."
"I'm sorry. I shall be more careful."
He waited to have her open a subject of conversation. She said nothing. He thought suddenly that she had never spoken to him first, in the 20 months of their marriage. He told himself that that was ridiculous and impossible. He tried to recall an occasion when she had addressed him. Of course he had. He remembered her asking him, "What time will you be back tomorrow?" And, "Do you wish to include the Dixons for Tuesday's dinner?" and many things like that. He glanced at her. She did not look bored or anxious to ignore him. She sat there, alert and ready, as if his company held her full interest. She did not reach for a book. She did not stare at some distant thought of her own. She looked straight at him, not past him, as if she were waiting for a conversation. He realized that she had always looked straight at him like this, and now he wondered whether he liked it. Yes, he did. It allowed him no cause to be jealous, not even of her hidden thoughts. No, he didn't, not quite. It allowed no escape for either one of them.
"I've just finished The Gallant Gallstone," he said. "It's a swell book. It's the product of a scintillating brain, a Puck with tears streaming down his face, a golden-hearted clown holding for a moment the throne of God."
"I read the same book review, in the Sunday Banner."
"I read the book itself. You know I did."
"That was nice of you."
"Huh?
He heard approval, and it pleased him. It was considerate toward the author. I'm sure she likes to have people read her book. So it was kind to take the time, when you knew in advance what you'd think of it.
I didn't know, but I happened to agree with the reviewer.
The Banner has the best reviewers.
That's true. Of course. So there's nothing wrong in agreeing with them, is there?
Nothing whatever. I always agree.
With whom?
With everybody.
Are you making fun of me, Dominique?
Have you given me reason to?
No. I don't see how. No, of course I haven't.
Then I'm not.
He waited. He heard a truck rumbling past in the street below, and that filled a few seconds. But when the sound died, he had to speak again. Dominique, I'd like to know what you think.
Of what?
Of... He searched for an important subject, and ended with... Of Vincent Knowlton.
I think he's a man worth kissing the backside of.
For Christ's sake, Dominique!
I'm sorry. That's bad English and bad manners. It's wrong, of course. Well, let's see. Vincent Knowlton is a man whom it's pleasant to know. Old families deserve a great deal of consideration, and we must have tolerance for the opinions of others, because tolerance is the greatest virtue. Therefore, it would be unfair to force your views on Vincent Knowlton. And if you just let him believe what he pleases, he will be glad to help you too, because he's a very human person.
Now that's sensible, said Keating. He felt at home in recognizable language. I think tolerance is very important, because... He stopped. He finished in an empty voice. You said exactly the same thing as before.
Did you notice that? She said.
She said it without question mark, indifferently, as a simple fact. It was not sarcasm. He wished it were. Sarcasm would have granted him a personal recognition, the desire to hurt him. But her voice had never carried any personal relation to him. Not for 20 months. He stared into the fire. That was what made a man happy, to sit looking dreamily into a fire at his own hearth in his own home. That's what he had always heard and read. He stared at the flames, unblinking, to force himself into a complete obedience to an established truth. Just one more minute of it, and I will feel happy, he thought, concentrating. Nothing happened. He thought of how convincingly he could describe this scene to friends and make them envy the fullness of his contentment. Why couldn't he convince himself? He had everything he'd ever wanted. He had wanted superiority, and for the last year he had been the undisputed leader of his profession. He had wanted fame, and he had 5 thick albums of clippings. He had wanted wealth, and he had enough to ensure luxury for the rest of his life. He had everything anyone ever wanted. How many people struggled and suffered to achieve what he had achieved? How many dreamed and bled and died for this without reaching it? Peter Keating is the luckiest fellow on earth. How often had he heard that? This last year had been the best of his life. He had added the impossible to his possessions, Dominique Francon. It had been such a joy to laugh casually when friends repeated to him, Peter, how did you ever do it? It had been such a pleasure to introduce her to strangers, to say lightly, my wife, and to watch the stupid uncontrolled look of envy in their eyes. Once at a large party, an elegant drunk had asked him, with a wink, declaring unmistakable intentions, "Say, do you know that gorgeous creature over there?" "Slightly," Keating had answered, gratified. "She's my wife." He often told himself gratefully that their marriage had turned out much better than he had expected. Dominique had become an ideal wife. She devoted herself completely to his interests, pleasing his clients, entertaining his friends, running his home. She changed nothing in his existence, not his hours, not his favorite menus, not even the arrangement of his furniture. She had brought nothing with her except her clothes. She had not added a single book or ashtray to his house. When he expressed his views on any subject, she did not argue. She agreed with him. Graciously, as a matter of natural course, she took second place, vanishing in his background. He had expected a torrent that would lift him and smash him against some unknown rocks. He had not found even a brook joining his peaceful river. It was more as if the river went on and someone came to swim quietly in his wake.
No, not even to swim. That was a cutting, forceful action, but just to float behind him with the current.
Had he been offered the power to determine Dominique's attitude after their marriage, he would have asked that she behave exactly as she did. Only their nights left him miserably unsatisfied. She submitted whenever he wanted her, but it was always as on their first night, an indifferent body in his arms, without revulsion, without answer. As far as he was concerned, she was still a virgin. He had never made her experience anything. Each time, burning with humiliation, he decided never to touch her again, but his desire returned, aroused by the constant presence of her beauty. He surrendered to it when he could resist no longer. Not often. It was his mother who stated the thing he had not admitted to himself about his marriage.
"I can't stand it," his mother said 6 months after the wedding. "If she'd just get angry at me once, call me names, throw things at me, it would be all right. But I can't stand this."
"What, mother?" he asked, feeling a cold hint of panic.
"It's no use, Peter," she answered.
His mother, whose arguments, opinions, reproaches he had never been able to stop, would not say another word about his marriage. She took a small apartment of her own and moved out of his house. She came to visit him often, and she was always polite to Dominique, with a strange, beaten air of resignation. He told himself that he should be glad to be free of his mother. But he was not glad. Yet he could not grasp what Dominique had done to inspire that mounting dread within him. He could find no word or gesture for which to reproach her. But for 20 months it had been like tonight. He could not bear to remain alone with her, yet he did not want to escape her, and she did not want to avoid him. "Nobody's coming tonight?" he asked tonelessly, turning away from the fire. "No," she said, and smiled, the smile serving as connection to her next words. "Shall I leave you alone, Peter?"
"No."
It was almost a cry. "I must not sound so desperate," he thought, while he was saying aloud, "Of course not. I'm glad to have an evening with my wife all to myself." He felt a dim instinct telling him that he must solve this problem, must learn to make their moments together endurable, that he dare not run from it, for his own sake more than hers. "What would you like to do tonight, Dominique?"
"Anything you wish."
"Want to go to a movie?"
"Do you?"
"Oh, I don't know. It kills time."
"All right, let's kill time."
"No, why should we? That sounds awful."
"Does it?"
"Why should we run from our own home? Let's stay here."
"Yes, Peter."
He waited. But the silence, he thought, is a flight, too, a worse kind of flight. "Want to play a hand of Russian bank?" he asked.
"Do you like Russian bank?"
"Oh, it kills time."
He stopped.
She smiled. "Dominique," he said, looking at her,
"you're so beautiful.
You're always so utterly beautiful. I always want to tell you how I feel about it."
"I'd like to hear how you feel about it, Peter."
"I love to look at you. I always think of what Gordon Prescott said. He said that you were God's perfect exercise in structural mathematics. And Vincent Knowlton said you're a spring morning. And Ellsworth said you're a reproach to every other female shape on earth."
"And Ralston Holcomb?" she asked.
"Oh, never mind," he snapped, and turned back to the fire. "I know why I can't stand the silence," he thought. "It's because it makes no difference to her at all whether I speak or not, as if I didn't exist and never had existed. The thing more inconceivable than one's death, never to have been born." He felt a sudden desperate desire which he could identify, a desire to be real to her. "Dominique, do you know what I've been thinking?" he asked eagerly.
"No. What have you been thinking?"
"I've thought of it for some time, all by myself. I haven't mentioned it to anyone, and nobody suggested it. It's my own idea."
"Well, that's fine.
What is it?" "I think I'd like to move to the country and build a house of our own. Would you like that?"
"I'd like it very much.
Just as much as you would."
"You want to design a home for yourself?"
"Hell no. Bennett will dash one off for me. He does all our country homes. He's a whiz at it."
"Will you like commuting?" Now, I think that will be quite an awful nuisance, but you know everybody that's anybody commutes nowadays. I always feel like a damn proletarian when I have to admit that I live in the city.
Will you like to see trees and a garden, and the earth around you?
Oh, that's a lot of nonsense. When will I have the time? A tree's a tree. When you've seen a newsreel of the woods in spring, you've seen it all.
Will you like to do some gardening? People say it's very nice, working the soil yourself.
Good God, no. What kind of grounds do you think we'd have? We can afford a gardener and a good one, so the place will be something for the neighbors to admire.
Will you take up some sport?
Yes, I like that.
Which one?
I think I'll do better with my golf. You know, belonging to a country club right where you're one of the leading citizens in the community is different from occasional weekends. And the people you meet are different, much higher class. And the contacts you make.
He caught himself and added angrily,
Also, I'll take up horseback riding.
I like horseback riding. Do you?
I've never had much time for it. Well, it does shake your insides unmercifully. But who the hell is Gordon Prescott to think he's the only He-Man on Earth and plaster his photo in riding clothes right in the reception room?
I suppose you will want to find some privacy.
Well, I don't believe in that desert island stuff. I think the house should stand in sight of a major highway so people would point it out. You know, the Keating estate. Who the hell is Claude Stengel to have a country home while I live in a rented flat? He started out about the same time I did, and look where he is and where I am. Why, he's lucky if 2.5 men ever heard of him. So why should he park himself in Westchester and...
And he stopped. She sat looking at him, her face serene.
Oh, God damn it, he cried. If you don't want to move to the country, why don't you just say so?
I want very much to do anything you want, Peter, to follow any idea you get all by yourself.
He remained silent for a long time. What do we do tomorrow night? He asked, before he could stop himself. She rose, walked to a desk, and picked up her calendar.
We have the Palmers for dinner tomorrow night, she said.
Oh, Christ, he moaned. They're such awful bores. Why do we have to have them?
She stood holding the calendar forward between the tips of her fingers, as if she were a photograph with the focus on the calendar and her own figure blurred in its background. We have to have the Palmers, she said, so that we can get the commission for their new store building. We have to get that commission so that we can entertain the Eddingtons for dinner on Saturday. The Eddingtons have no commissions to give, but they're in the social register. The Palmers bore you, and the Eddingtons snub you, but you have to flatter people whom you despise in order to impress other people who despise you.
Why do you have to say things like that?
Would you like to look at this calendar, Peter?
Well, that's what everybody does. That's what everybody lives for.
Yes, Peter. Almost everybody.
If you don't approve, why don't you say so?
Have I said anything about not approving?
He thought back carefully. No, he admitted. No, you haven't. But it's the way you put things.
Would you rather I put it in a more involved way, as I did about Vincent Knowlton?
I'd rather... Then he cried. I'd rather you'd express an opinion, God damn it, just once.
She asked, in the same level monotone. Whose opinion, Peter? Gordon Prescott's? Ralston Holcomb's? Ellsworth Toohey's?
He turned to her, leaning on the arm of his chair, half rising, suddenly tense. The thing between them was beginning to take shape. He had a first hint of words that would name it.
Dominique, he said softly, reasonably. That's it.
Now I know. I know what's been the matter all the time.
Has anything been the matter?
Wait, this is terribly important. Dominique, you've never said not once what you thought, not about anything. You've never expressed a desire. Not of any kind.
What's wrong about that?
But it's like death. You're not real. You're only a body.
Look, Dominique, you don't know it. I'll try to explain. You understand what death is? When a body can't move anymore, when it has no will, no meaning. You understand? Nothing. The absolute nothing. Well, your body moves, but that's all. The other, the thing inside you, oh, don't misunderstand me, I'm not talking religion, but there's no other word for it, so I'll say,
your soul. Your soul doesn't exist. No will, no meaning. There's no real you anymore.
What's the real me? She asked. For the first time she looked attentive. Not compassionate, but at least attentive. What's the real anyone? He said, encouraged. It's not just the body. It's the soul.
What is the soul?
It's you. The thing inside you.
The thing that thinks and values and makes decisions?
Yes, that's it. And the thing that feels. You've given it up.
So there are two things that one can't give up. One's thoughts and one's desires?
Yes. Oh, you do understand. So you see, you're like a corpse to everybody around you, a kind of walking death. That's worse than any active crime. It's...
negation?
Yes, just blank negation. You're not here. You've never been here. If you'd tell me that the curtains in this room are ghastly, and if you'd rip them off and put up some you like, something of you would be real, here, in this room, but you never have. You've never told the cook what dessert you liked for dinner. You're not here, Dominique. You're not alive. Where's your I?
Where's yours, Peter?
She asked quietly. He sat still, his eyes wide. She knew that his thoughts in this moment were clear and immediate, like visual perception, that the act of thinking was an act of seeing a procession of years behind him. It's not true, he said at last, his voice hollow. It's not true.
What is not true?
What you said.
I've said nothing. I asked you a question.
His eyes were begging her to speak, to deny. She rose, stood before him, and the taut erectness of her body was a sign of life, the life he had missed and begged for, a positive quality of purpose, but the quality of a judge.
You're beginning to see, aren't you, Peter? Shall I make it clearer? You never wanted me to be real. You never wanted anyone to be, but you didn't want me to show it. You wanted an act to help your act, a beautiful, complicated act, all twists, trimmings, and words. All words. You didn't like what I said about Vincent Knowlton. You liked it when I said the same thing under cover of virtuous sentiments. You didn't want me to believe. You only wanted me to convince you that I believed. My real soul, Peter? It's real only when it's independent. You've discovered that, haven't you? It's real only when it chooses curtains and desserts. You're right about that. Curtains, desserts, and religions, Peter, and the shapes of buildings. But you've never wanted that. You wanted a mirror. People want nothing but mirrors around them, to reflect them while they're reflecting, too. You know, like the senseless infinity you get from two mirrors facing each other across a narrow passage, usually in the more vulgar kind of hotels. Reflections of reflections and echoes of echoes, no beginning and no end, no center and no purpose. I gave you what you wanted. I became what you are, what your friends are, what most of humanity is so busy being, only without the trimmings. I didn't go around spouting book reviews to hide my emptiness of judgment. I said I had no judgment. I didn't borrow designs to hide my creative impotence. I created nothing. I didn't say that equality is a noble conception and unity the chief goal of mankind. I just agreed with everybody. You call it death, Peter? That kind of death. I've imposed it on you and on everyone around us. But you? You haven't done that. People are comfortable with you. They like you. They enjoy your presence. You've spared them the blank death. Because you've imposed it on yourself. He said nothing. She walked away from him and sat down again, waiting. He got up, he made a few steps toward her. He said, Dominique. Then he was on his knees before her, clutching her, his head buried against her legs. Dominique, it's not true that I never loved you. I love you, I always have. It was not just to show the others. That was not all. I loved you. There were two people, you and another person, a man, who always made me feel the same thing. Not fear exactly, but like a wall, a steep wall to climb, like a command to rise. I don't know where, but a feeling going up. I've always hated that man, but you, I wanted you, always. That's why I married you. When I knew you despised me, so you should have forgiven me that marriage. You shouldn't have taken your revenge like this. Not like this, Dominique. Dominique, I can't fight back. Who is the man you hated, Peter? It doesn't matter. Who is he? Nobody. I name him. Howard Rourke. She said nothing for a long time. Then she put her hand on his hair. The gesture had the form of gentleness. I never wanted to take revenge on you, Peter, she said softly. Then, why? I married you for my own reasons. I acted as the world demands one should act. Only I can do nothing halfway. Those who can have a fissure somewhere inside. Most people have many. They lie to themselves, not to know that. I've never lied to myself. So I had to do what you all do, only consistently and completely. I've probably destroyed you. If I could care, I'd say I'm sorry. That was not my purpose.
Dominique, I love you.
But I'm afraid. Because you've changed something in me ever since our wedding, since I said yes to you. Even if I were to lose you now, I couldn't go back to what I was before. You took something I had. No, I took something you never had. I grant you, that's worse.
What?
It's said that the worst thing one can do to a man is to kill his self-respect, but that's not true. Self-respect is something that can't be killed. The worst thing is to kill a man's pretense at it.
Dominique, I don't want to talk.
She looked down at his face resting against her knees, and he saw pity in her eyes. And for one moment he knew what a dreadful thing true pity is. But he kept no knowledge of it because he slammed his mind shut before the words in which he was about to preserve it. She bent down and kissed his forehead. It was the first kiss she had ever given him.
I don't want you to suffer, Peter, she said gently. This, now, is real. It's I. It's my own words. I don't want you to suffer. I can't feel anything else, but I feel that much.
He pressed his lips to her hand. When he raised his head, she looked at him as if for a moment he was her husband. She said,
Peter, if you could hold on to it, to what you are now.
I love you, he said.
They sat silently together for a long time. He felt no strain in the silence. The telephone rang. It was not the sound that destroyed the moment, it was the eagerness with which Keating jumped up and ran to answer it. She heard his voice through the open door, a voice indecent in its relief. Hello?
Oh, hello, Ellsworth. No, not a thing. Free as a lark. Sure, come over. Come right over. Okie doke.
It's Ellsworth, he said, returning to the living room. His voice was gay, and it had a touch of insight.